Being a girl that was raised in a strict Catholic background in a small country town in Iowa, and I was pregnant when I was in college, unmarried, I didn't tell my family I even had a baby. I didn't tell my family that Christopher was born until the day Christopher was born. I found myself to be an incredible outsider in my family, so everything I did seemed to happen really in my own world. I was looking to move as far away from my home in Iowa and anything I knew as possible. So Washington, D.C. was about as far away as I could get. I was in art school. I was 22, living in Washington, D.C., all alone. So my son was born in 1988, but he was conceived on a trip I took on the back of a Harley. I bought the Harley from my boyfriend at the time. Christopher was conceived on a raucous night in Mexico on the Baja coast amongst a lot of tequila shots, and I knew it the moment that it happened. I absolutely knew it. I just knew it. And then I remember I had to go back to school 10 days later, and I had said goodbye to the father, the presumed eventual father of this child, in front of the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard on January 14th, 1988. Knew pretty much I would never ever see him again. My pregnancy, I remember being exciting, even though it was I was the only one participating in it, and there was nothing like baby showers with, you know, crepe paper. It was a lot like the conception was. It was based with strange friends around me who had a lot of drug and alcohol problems, and I was trying to keep it together and try to figure out how I'm going to create a life for this child in the future, and what was I going to do in Washington, D.C. with this child as an art school graduate. When I really realized how pregnant I was, 2 months in, I quit smoking marijuana immediately. I quit doing any kind of drug that I was used to doing, including ecstasy, anything. And I became an artist model to support myself. And that was an interesting transition for me as a woman, to go from being a very young, really sexual young woman who felt really uncomfortable. And I found interesting that I liked myself physically more, because when I was an artist model and I was taking my clothes off now, it didn't seem sexual. Before I was an artist model and before I had Christopher, I'd also worked in a strip club. Not as a dancer though, because I so don't look like a dancer. However, I had this desperate need when I was in college to be objectified as a woman, which sounds like a totally weird thing in the age of feminism, but I needed to know where I was or a placement as a woman or what men thought about me, because growing up I'd had really bad experiences with boyfriends, with brothers, with my father, and so I wanted to be seen, I think in some ways to help me get over a lot of body image, which, you know, became the narrative, the narrative arc that ran through all of my life as a young woman. My nickname as a child was Ellen Capellan the Watermelon. That was the nice nickname. The nickname I grew up with that caused me all the trouble in my life was Double Ugly. Double Ugly. I loathed the nickname. I loathed it. And I was known as Double Ugly and Ellen Capellan the Watermelon and Smelling Ellen so much that by the time I'd run away from home, and I mean run away from home and never speak to your family again, I needed to somehow psychologically unravel these nicknames and these impressions I had of myself. And so I put myself in these really bizarre situations, like working in a really high-end strip club on M Street in Washington, D.C. I felt that I needed to learn something about myself. So for about 5 months, I cocktailed 5 nights a week, dressed as a Playboy bunny just to work through this body image thing I had. But I think even more so was gaining all this weight while I was pregnant and really getting comfortable with myself. Moving into motherhood and accepting myself as sort of, diva sitting on a lotus flower for people to paint and seeing me as an object of beauty and fertility. I wouldn't get up on a stage and take my clothes off for money, but I would get up on a stage and take off my clothes to have people make art. People told me I couldn't have this child, and I explored abortion options. I went far. Scheduling having an abortion in Washington, D.C., because the father wasn't involved, and I was just so beyond what I could do, and I felt that this was the only thing I could do. And I go to the appointment, and the doctor doesn't show up. And I'm like, oh my God. I remember the Women's Health Clinic made another appointment for me in New York City, and I was supposed to drive to New York City and have an abortion. I thought I could do this, and I planned to do it. I made the appointment. I was going to do it all alone. And once again, something happens where they call me and say, not going to happen, doctor doesn't come. I mean, this freak experience. I could never figure out how this came to be that now I'm past. I'm so far past the time of even considering this that I recognize I'm having a baby. This conception is a surprise. This even idea that I'm going to have a baby is a surprise. I'm sleeping on a couch at a friend's house with my dog. I have no money, and I can't call my family and tell them. It was an amazingly complicated time, but, you know, friends were kind of around. And then a friend volunteered to go through birthing classes with me. We did something called the Bradley Method, which was based on intuitive connectedness, which I really liked, and what exactly was going to happen that day when you went to the hospital. And so I felt psychologically probably more prepared than other people seem to have told me they were when they went in to have a baby. I felt pretty ready about what was going to happen that day because I'd written a birth plan. And I was working with midwives, which was a little different than going to a hospital. There were often different people in the room. So there would be students there, and there would be maybe a different midwife than I'd had the last time. So it was sort of like, Ellen's having a baby, and it's a community event. And so when the actual day came in the hospital, I do remember lots of people came in to watch. It was more like a learning experience and an art happening kind of thing, or at least I thought when I was going in, it was a living be there event. So people were kind of invited to come, and people showed up, which was nice. There were a number of women in the room. The best thing I remember happening was that this woman came in the room that I had never met before, and that she was not a midwife I had been introduced to previously, but she came into the room, I remember, and I didn't have a long labor. It had started the night before, and I didn't tell the people in my house, but I knew it was through the night. I knew I was laboring alone, which for me always seemed like the most natural thing to do is just, you're in your own headspace. But this woman came in, and she was like this angel. And I remember her sitting down behind me and saying to me, you're not in pain. You're just connected to this bigger part of the universe. And these sensations you're feeling are all a part of this birth process. And there's nothing here that's going to hurt you. And you're going to be fine. And we're going to breathe through this. And she just held me with this huge sense of love. And I remember, even though my son's father was not there and he didn't know the baby was being born that day, I could feel him in the room. I felt my grandma in the room who had passed away about 6 months earlier. I felt this huge sense of love in the room. And so for me, the whole birthing part went very quickly. There was no pain, and I remember having a primal scream that was extremely exciting. It just felt like the Big Bang Theory was in me, and I loved it. I loved the birthing part. That part, I remember thinking, was great. It was so different than what other people told me afterwards and people wanted to share with me before. It was exciting. It was a roller coaster. I remember things like being offered an epidural, and I said, oh no, this will be the one thing I will do totally drug-free. I will remember every sensation and every moment. I needed it to be just a clear, clear headspace because I felt this need to go so deep in my head and into my psyche. I didn't want it to be as much of a physical experience. I wanted this deeply spiritual connectedness because I thought, this is it. It's, you know, life is a one-time thing, and this is probably the only time I'm going to have a child. This is the only child I'm going to have with this man. And I wanted it to be perfection. I wanted it to be something I would never forget, filled with details that I would want to share again, that hopefully would enable someone else. If I kept telling this story over and over, someone else would hear this and say, I'm going to have a birth like that. I'm going to have this sort of experience where angels are in the room singing, and you feel like this is what I was meant to do. I did not talk to the father of Christopher. My son's name is Christopher Robin. And then I saw him again 18 years later when Christopher graduated from high school and he finally wanted to reconnect with his father. And by then I was married. I'd been married for many years. And I was way over the pain of being left. So after an exhaustive search, lots of phone callings, lots of calling to the universe, I gave his father a deadline, like in my mind. It was very specific. It was 12 o'clock, March 15th, during the last commercial set of The Young and the Restless, which I used to draw to every day without fail for 20-some years. Those were studio hours for me. I had told a friend the night before, if he doesn't call by tomorrow, I quit thinking about him. It's been 18 years. You know, a girl's got to move on, even in her heart. I'd been holding this man in my heart even though I was married. But I had reached out 2 months before looking for him, just out of curiosity. And since I hadn't had a call back, I decided that morning at noon, that was when we would never think about this anymore and I would have to call it quits. And I'll tell you, at 11:57, I swear it's the truth, 11:57, the phone rings. I turn it over and I see the caller ID. I take a huge breath, like your first gasp of air, you know, out of water, and I pick up the phone and I said, is it really you? And he said, yes, it's really me. I said, I can't believe you made it in 3 minutes. And he's like, I'm on time, aren't I? The conversation, I remember, flowed like we had just spoken maybe 2 hours ago. Because I said, I'd waited 18 years. I've waited 18 years. I gave you till noon. You made it. You made it at 11:56. 11:58, you made it? He said, well, I'm under the wire. He had a lifestyle in Hollywood that, you know, basically shamed Charlie Sheen. He made Charlie Sheen look like a choir boy during his life in Hollywood. So when I found him again, he looked the same. He was still stunningly handsome, but he had changed a bit. He was more settled, and he was a person now who could work consistently and maintained a fairly seemingly normal lifestyle. He was no longer a roadie for Ozzy Osbourne. And the thing was, the electricity was immediate. It was just, I felt like I was in a way back time machine. Here I was presenting myself to this man again, almost like a bride would. And I really mean that. It was the first time in my life since I was 22 that I had some freedom. Here I was, a 42-year-old woman with some cash in the bank and some time on my hands. I sounded like an Eagles song, and I just played it out over 3 weekends, you know, having a torrid affair. I really, really did, because I needed to know. I needed to know I was a woman, because I'd lived through a marriage with celibacy. 100% 100% celibacy, including my wedding night. I swear it's the truth. And so here I was, a woman with a child, left the nest now because he was 18. He was going off to college. My husband had moved away to move on with his career and expected me to follow him again in my celibate marriage now of 15 years. And I was a young woman suddenly with freedom like I hadn't known. I felt like I was 22 again, or who I wanted to be when I was 22. And it was almost like I recapitulated right back again to where I was. And 3 months later, I was pregnant. It was not a happy pregnancy the second time. You would have thought the first pregnancy would have been really sad and under tragic circumstances, but it wasn't. And this one, the second one with my son, Ansel Jackson, was fraught with sadness. Here I was with the man I always wanted to be with, that I thought about for 18 years, and yet I was in the middle of a messy divorce and ending a life I had no intention really maybe of ending. I hadn't really thought, when I was having an affair and figuring out what's sex, you know, it was Paradise Bed, the dashboard life. It was a Meatloaf song and I couldn't get over it. And I just didn't think, oh, what's it going to be like when I unravel all of my life, my grown-up life? What's that going to be like? And so my pregnancy when I was 42 was a hidden secret pregnancy. It was totally secret. I hid in my house. I didn't let next door neighbors or close friends see me. No one knew it was happening but my closest friends who maybe lived out of town. The father by then had decided to come move to Arizona to be with me. He now was the one interested in having a child, and I was not. I was the one who said, I can't trust you. You've left other children. I can't trust you well enough to have a child. And I'm a big grown-up adult who knows what it's like to raise a child alone, and I didn't think I could do it. So there was a lot of disharmony. Christopher had to then reconnect while I was pregnant in front of him with a father he had never known. While he was disconnecting from me, it was turmoil in a house that should have been able to come together, but it was not. And so I decided when I was pregnant, I wasn't going to be able to keep this child. I don't know what I was thinking, but I totally said, I can't keep this child. There's just no way. There have to be people better than us to raise a child. We're not in a relationship. This is not a marriage. I'm still technically married to somebody else at this point. This is not a good situation for a child to be raised in. And me raising a child as a single mother a second time, I went through the desperate search of finding the perfect people to adopt my child while I'm living here with the father who's willing to do this for me because I've already raised one of our kids, so he doesn't have a whole lot of cards to play in the whole game here. He better just be supportive. And he was, but he really, I could tell, wanted to keep the baby. But I began a search. I found a couple. We met with them. We had lunch. I met their child. I conversed back and forth with them. We moved ahead with details. And then my gut told me something wasn't right. Something wasn't right about the situation. We're only maybe 3 weeks from delivery date. And something besides the baby inside of me is saying, something's not entirely right. And I'm not getting the answers I need from the adoption agency about the adoptive couple. And I am questioning things and I'm feeling things. And I'm a prayer. I'm praying to God, show me the way. I'm screaming in my backyard, help me, help me, help me. Show me what it is. And I find out that this family has had some problems. The father's been in federal prison for embezzling maybe $2 million from one of his clients. I did not want my child raised in a family where money was an ongoing issue because I've already heard these arguments in my past. I've heard this as my childhood. This is part of my verbal memory. And I think they're lying to me. They got a lot of skeletons in their closet. I'm sure they're nice people. I'm sure time served, everybody's nice people, but I didn't feel good. So I immediately discontinued my relationship with them. I consulted another adoption representative immediately who put me in touch with the most amazing family ever. Professors at a university, a couple. They're perfect, except they're on their way to Brazil to do a little research. So I tell them, I can do this by myself. I can birth this baby by myself. I can wait until you come back to Brazil, and then I'll give you the baby. I think I can do this because I think I'm really generous. I think I'm so generous and so wanting to do the right thing for my child, for his future, that I can live through whatever this pain is. I can live through this. This is okay. So the family is off in Brazil, and I'm not a happy woman at all. I've gained a lot of weight. I've been in hiding now for months. I haven't told anyone I'm having a baby. I did not bother having birthing classes. There was no nursery prepared in the house. There was no diaper. There was no plan for a child. I was literally psychologically thinking, I'm doing the right thing and I'll get through this. It's going to take some counseling. I'm going to get through this, but I'm going to have done the right thing for someone. So we go to the hospital. Mind you, I feel that I can have a baby by myself. So I don't go until 20 minutes before the baby's going to be born. Skipped all that walking, all that, you know, anything, ice chips, anything anybody else ever talked about in their birthing story wasn't a part of it. We just went into the room. I said, it's time to have the baby because I was ready to be done now. It was an easy delivery. I remember even thinking ahead, I'm going to be getting up on my feet and squatting. I could be, because I used to say to people, I literally could deliver in a field, pick up the child and move on and work. Because I was just such a worker, such a Midwestern girl. And I literally went back home with the baby the next day and thought, I'm waiting for somebody to come back from Brazil to get their child. And I started nursing the baby. And you know how, even if you don't think you're bonding with a child, you are bonding with a child. You might not be looking at your child and thinking, oh, they have their father's eyes, or they have a nose like their grandfather. Those weren't the thoughts. I think it's the unverbal moments. It's the back and forth symbiotic energy between you and your child. And this is where it changes. I see the father now with this child in his arms, this baby with his father and the way he holds him. And I think, oh, this is what this older father now, this father now is 51 years old, who's never raised any of his kids. He has four other children he's never raised. Here he is in front of me, and I am seeing him for the first time in this loving parental role. And I think, this is his child. I'm letting him bond with this child. Maybe I'm letting him bond with this child because I don't want him to leave. And so for about the next week, although I was nursing the baby, I knew I was psychologically stepping back. This was really more about him having this time. And I start to realize this baby is not leaving us. This baby is not going anywhere. I remember the adoption person came to us. The family came back and we had to take the baby. We wrote down a name. I didn't choose the name. The baby's father chose his name, Ansel Jackson. I remember he'd seen a number of Ansel Adams PBS documentaries. I think the name was in his mind, but it also connected to my work as an artist and doing large landscape paintings, my drawings. There was a visual connection. So he chose the name and he went along with the idea that we were going to still adopt this baby, but somewhere in my mind I thought, I don't know if we're really, really doing this. But we did get in the car. We did go to the family's home and we left that baby for a night. We drove back home without the baby. And I got up the next morning and I walked in my backyard and I screamed, "What have I done? What have I done? What have I done?" And so I called the new mother and I begged for my child back. And I cried and I begged and I begged and I cried and I didn't have a leg to stand on. And they politely argued with me, very politely, very kind, and said, "We don't have to do this." And I said, "Of course I know you don't have to. I know you don't have to do this for me." And they agreed to let me come and get my son. So I drive and I pick up this child and I pull this child from this woman's arms. This mother was so good. She looked at her daughter, her five-year-old at the time, and said, "Well, let's just think of it as we took care of the baby for a night and that he was our baby for a night and that was good enough for us." And I thought, man, that's a good mother. She's weeping. I'm weeping. Everyone's crying. No one's happy. And I know I have broken hearts. I have broken a family. I look at a grandmother there visiting and she tells me, "You've broken hearts." And I know I've broken hearts. I know everyone hates me. I'm in turmoil and pain. There's nothing happy about it. And we take the baby home and I'm not happy. The baby's with us, but I'm not happy. I did this very hurtful thing. And I was going to have to do a lot of soul searching trying to make everything okay with people. And I remember driving to the Walmart and thinking, "What am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? Now I have a baby living with me. In my adult life, my very manicured, perfect adult life, there's nowhere in my house have I thought about a child coming or what's going to happen. But I'm in a situation light years different than I was 20 years before when I had my first child. And yet, I wasn't prepared at all. But I was told, I knew you don't need color schemes in a bedroom and a mural painted. None of that is necessary. You need some diapers. And so I went to Walmart and got diapers and thought, I can't believe this is happening. We're moving forward with this, but this is what we're doing. And it really became a one day at a time. Really, really, really slowly. There was no excitement of a family. There were no phone calls. There were no flowers. There was nothing that said, this is a cherished experience. Instead, it was this beautiful child that came to a broken home. But the thing that became magical about this child is that Jack Ansel Jackson, who's always been known as Jack, began the beginning of a family. There were remnants of his family everywhere when he was born, and all of these siblings started to meet each other. The two brothers in Los Angeles met for the first time and became very close, adore each other. And a family started to come together that had never been a family. Suddenly, Jack had two parents he was growing up with, and Christopher had two parents living in a house for the first time that knew each other, and he had the older brother that he had always prayed for but never knew that he had, that he's very, very close with as an adult, and he had the younger brother that he always wanted, and this family that had no connection throughout its seeming life suddenly now is coalescing around this baby, like he's the fire. He's the fire that holds us all together, and we all couldn't get close enough to him.